Michael Katutwa Johnson is a scientist. He has a PhD in natural resources. He studied at Cornell. He's also a member of the Hopi tribe in Arizona and a traditional dryland farmer there. In fact, he told us he's a 120th generation farmer. So the way he thinks of growing things comes from practices that have been passed down for thousands of years. That's years and years of observing weather conditions, years of trial and error. And so his farm on the Hopi Indian Reservation is now carefully calibrated to this place his people have always lived, but is exceedingly dry. Last year, Johnson went out to his fields in April, getting ready for another planting season, and things didn't look right.
I remember last year, you know, walking around. We do this every year. A bunch of us farmers get together and we go out and we look at the vegetation that lies in our fields. That's one of our key indicators of whether we're going to have a good crop or not. There are things like rabbit brush and the thing we call mivy and hoisi, which is our tea. We didn't see any of these plants. We've been suffering from drought year after year for the last 3 or 4 years now, and so the plants that were there were dead from last year. When I saw that we didn't have any of those things there, I was like, man, I was really surprised. I said, we're going to have a pretty bad crop season this year.
You do have a battle within yourself of you don't want to waste your seeds, but what if I just didn't plant anything? Then I would have 100% chance of not raising anything. But if I do plant something, I still have that faith that maybe I will produce something.
We still decided to plant at least a quarter of our fields. When my people, the Hopi, came into this world, after coming from three different worlds below, we were given three things to ensure our survival. A planting stick, a gourd of water, and some seeds. And what was mentioned to us is that we need to have faith in everything in order to survive on this arid climate. We only get 6 to 10 inches of annual rainfall out here a year, but we chose to live here. We've been here for over 3,000 years. My grandfather had told me these stories before of times that we had drought and things that we had to do. Things as simple as taking seeds and building them into our plaster. I asked a person why he wanted me to do that when I was building my beautiful house. And he says, well, you do that because you always will remember that you have food in the house. This is knowledge that's been passed down from generation to generation to generation. All these years of observation living in a certain place that allows us to fine-tune and be part of the environment. All through the summertime, you know, I'd go out to our fields and I knew we weren't going to have a crop.
Walked out there a month later and there was still no plants coming up. A month later after that, still no plants coming up. I was just kind of discouraged about it.
I don't have any rain all the way from April. Lo and behold, the last week of July, we got these massive monsoon rains that came down. It's like watching somebody let down their hair. It just comes flowing. Rivers ran. Auroras filled up. 2 weeks later, these crops came up from an 18-inch depth. And it was just something special. It's kind of like Jiminy Crickets. It's like watching a baby being born. You know, it's got what it needs to survive. Just to see them start to come up and thrive. I wasn't able to harvest seed for them, but I was able to harvest enough to feed my family and also to provide corn for my relatives. on the Hopi Reservation, scarcity of water is our biggest issue. All of our ceremonies are geared towards bringing moisture. That's where our faith comes in. And so we do this year after year, ceremony after ceremony. We're always praying for these things to happen. You know, going back to that time of last year when I was able to raise something, despite the conditions, really instilled in me what the importance of traditional ecological knowledge is.
It just reaffirmed my whole belief system that, yeah, despite what I see, I just got to keep having faith.
So we really have to find a respect and a reverence for the things we use, not only with water, but in all aspects of life. But I've learned how to do this, and our people have learned for centuries, and so this is the way it's supposed to be. It's all about a reciprocal relationship, not one of just take, take, take.
It's Michael Katutwa Johnson. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we wanted to explore how Native American ideas about water differ from the ones brought by white settlers and planners. And we weren't just interested in the cultural distinctions, but the practices themselves and the ethic that underpins them. And it just so happens, a few years ago, a group of Native Americans and some water experts actually drew up a collection of these principles. They were looking for a way of getting beyond what's become this complex and adversarial process, but they also wanted to find a way to integrate traditional knowledge. This was in the fall of 2016 at the Desert Rose Resort in Bluff, Utah. So they became known as the Bluff Principles. And the water law expert, Dan McCool, was there.
The story goes back quite a ways for especially three of us. Jason Robison, who's a professor of law at the University of Wyoming, and John Weishite, who is the president of Living Rivers and also the Colorado Riverkeeper, and myself. And the three of us have been working with tribes on and off for many, many years. And we would often encounter people who would ask the question of me, well, what do Native Americans want? And I kept saying, why are you asking me? Ask them. And that question was asked so often, it became clear that there just wasn't much dialogue. So it just seemed incumbent upon us that we needed to put some of those ideas down from Native people and get it directly from them and present it in a publication so that when people say, well, what do Native Americans want? What's their approach? Here's a list of them. There's 16 of them. So we don't have to entertain that question anymore. And it is a starting point. These are aspirational. They are idealistic. And they're beautiful. They're the kind of goals to which we should aspire when we're making any kind of policy, really.
We'll get to some of the particular principles here in a moment. But what did that experience in 2016, what did that tell you just broadly about the Native American perspective to water that's different from the white perspective, I guess?
What really struck me about these as I looked through them is that they have a great deal in common with what us white people would call a brand new, innovative, creative concept that's based on ideas like ecosystem management, and integrated water resources, and collaborative problem solving. There's entire literatures on these in the water literature. And it just struck me that what we were presenting as new were actually the oldest ideas in the hemisphere, right? They were the ideas that Native American people have understood all along.
So let's talk about some of the particular principles then. As you said, 16 in total. And this is the part I want to be able to understand. Some of them, as you said, are more frankly, abstract and, as you say, broadly aspirational than explicitly practical, some of them anyway. For example, the principles that say there should be clean water for all people, that water is precious, that it is a gift provided by a creator, that it's important to honor sacred sites and religious beliefs, that there should be no racism or prejudice in this system, that it should be equitable. All that sounds good, but how do you apply something abstract like that and not entirely tangible to the complicated business of actually managing water in the West?
That's the great challenge before us. I just completed a study of how Native Americans were treated during the first 100 years of the 1922 Colorado River Compact. And the short answer to how they were treated is not well at all. They were ignored. And nowhere in any of those documents were Native Americans actually allocated water. They got zero. The only reason Native Americans have water today in the Colorado River Basin is because they won a series of court cases. That's the only reason. And if you look through the Bluff principles, you keep seeing the words inclusive and equity. The reason why that is so important to Native Americans is because the first 100 years was exclusive. And they were the ones who were excluded. And what they're really pointing out to us is that the last 100 years was an era of injustice. And they want the next 100 years to be an era of justice. And justice requires collaboration, inclusivity, equity for everyone.
What do you do with the parts of the principles? And I'm thinking, again, how this translates into practical, pragmatic terms. I have the arcane idea of water law on my mind here. What do you do with the parts of these principles that imply a spiritual component, that there is a creator overseeing the world? How do you apply, you know, in our system of government, where there's a separation of church and state, where that's important, how do you adopt a list of recommendations that have as a central premise this idea that a creator instilled a responsibility for caring for water? How does that translate, do you think?
I would love to hear from my Native American colleagues. I think they can answer that question better than I can. But from my perspective, that refers to a mindset. It refers to an attitude towards water. And if you look at a body of water and you say, that's only for me and I can do whatever I want and it doesn't matter who I harm, I think you're insulting the Creator. I think when we talk about sacredness, at least I can only give you my perspective, not a Native perspective, it means it's a precious gift. There's something here that needs to be respected, and if we're going to exploit it, we have to do so very carefully and respectfully with a vision to how what we do now affects future generations.
It seems important to say that these principles aren't just a bunch of touchy-feely notions, that there are references to methods and systems and particular ideas about policymaking. Let me ask you about one of the principles, and it suggests that it's important to use – here's how it goes – science to improve our understanding of water quality and quantity. Maybe say something about that, the importance of, again, applying science to all of this.
I think that fits in very nicely with the Bluff principles, because part of listening to everybody in the basin is listening to the scientists. If we're going to find a collaborative and fair way of reallocating water and dividing a shrinking amount of water, we need to listen to scientists who can tell us how much water we're really dealing with. And I think tribes today have an inherent interest in an accurate scientific analysis of what we're doing to groundwater, how much groundwater mining is going on, what we're doing to surface water flows, how much of a flow reduction in the Colorado River Basin will there be, what's happening with increased temperatures and climate change. All those things require sound science. And those are the people who can give us the facts on the ground that we need to make sound decisions.
Dan McCool, do you think that this legacy of colonialism needs to be addressed, if not at least needs to be addressed, maybe if not resolved, to be able to apply these principles? Do we need to get to that point, have a conversation about that before we talk about actually applying the principles themselves?
We can't change the past, the mistakes we made, the genocide we committed against Native Americans. We can't undo that. We could apologize for it. That doesn't bring back the 90 to 95% of the Native population that died as a result of our occupation of their homelands. I don't think looking back is going to help us as much as looking for a different future, a future that is in stark contrast to the colonialist nature of our past decisions. In everything I'm talking about, at no time did I say we should somehow mistreat white people or shortchange white people or only pay attention to Native people. I'm a white guy. I use water out here. I'd like to continue with my water use. I want it to be inclusive too. And in that, I think I have something very much in common with every Native American. They could say exactly what I just said, and they just want to be treated fairly. That's all I want, and that's what they want. That doesn't seem like it should be a lot to ask for, but in the past 100 years, it was a lot to ask for Native people. The next 100 years, it really needs to look different.
Can you imagine a scenario where this could or this would happen? That is, people in making policy in the West about water apply some of these principles. You actually use this document, and how would it change water law? How could it change the way we manage water? Could the application of these principles change our behavior, you know, the way we use water in the West? Like, are you seeing a practical scenario? Like, what are you seeing in the next 5 years or so where are you thinking, look, if we really took this seriously, we could adopt some of these principles in actual ways in the West?
I think there's two ways that's going to happen. The first way is there's a whole camp that's progressive that wants to respond to Native American needs, that is sensitive to that, that fully supports true equity among white people, Anglos and Native Americans. And there's another group of people out West, and they will be interested in a new water regime and a whole new approach when they turn on the tap and no water comes out. And they'll be in favor of the status quo up to that moment. And then they're going to say, oh my gosh, we need to do things differently because now we have a crisis. And every crisis is also an opportunity. And when the existing system no longer works, that really gives us an opportunity to build a new system. And we can do that collaboratively with not just Native Americans, but with everybody, farmers, ranchers, everybody. The important thing to understand at this time in the crisis that is going on in the Colorado River Basin is that there's really only two potential, I'm going to call them sources of increased water for urban growth. And urban growth is the problem. The cities in the Colorado River Basin are growing at outrageous rates, non-sustainable, absolutely non-sustainable. And those two sources are agricultural water and Native American water. How are we going to determine how much of that water and whose water becomes reallocated to urban use? That's the fundamental question for policymakers in the basin today. And farmers were among the first settlers to get here. They created water doctrines like the prior appropriation doctrine that were very much designed to protect them and their farms and their property and served them very well. I don't blame them. That made perfect sense. But that doesn't work so well today. So we're going to have to work with both farmers and Native Americans and work out a collaborative arrangement that is voluntary. I don't believe in forcing anybody to give up their water. A voluntary change of how water is used. And the best way to do that is to make it attractive. If we can set up water marketing arrangements in some situations, that will help. Some tribes may be interested in marketing or leasing their water. That should be entirely up to them, not up to white people living around them. It should be the choice of every tribe, how much they want to participate in marketing. And here's an opportunity to deal with farmers and Native Americans and tribes on a basis that's quite different from in the past. And ultimately, we cannot have infinite growth in a finite system. We cannot base our economy on building more and more subdivisions and trying to attract more people. I realize that's just absolutely toxic in the political environment. That discussion won't take place outside of academia for some time. In the meantime, what we're going to have to do is work closely with tribes and the agricultural community and try to come up with some solutions there.
It sort of leads us finally to another one of the principles that says there should be, and I'll quote it here, a sense of urgency. We must act now before the problems become overwhelming. So it seems implied in that is that the people who drafted these principles are like, these aren't just touchy-feely notions. These are things that we should act on and get to it, I guess.
I think the sense of urgency became quite apparent when the Commissioner of Reclamation just issued a notification that there will be drastic reductions in the lower Colorado River Basin. Unprecedented. The level of Lake Powell, if they weren't sacrificing upstream reservoirs like Flaming Gorge to keep Powell up to a certain level, it would no longer be producing hydropower. So there's a whole series of sort of reality checks that are taking place that are forcing people to stand up and take notice and say, oh my gosh, this is urgent. And one of the ideas that I've been working on with some colleagues is what we call crisis collaboration. Collaboration with a short time window, very high stakes, and very clear winners and losers. That's how we define crisis collaboration. Those are the most difficult conditions under which to collaborate. But because we've waited so long to deal with this, that's the situation we're in. So our commitment to justice, kindness, respect will be sorely tested as we try to solve our problems in the Colorado River Basin. And I hope we come out of it with a sense of justice and come up with solutions that all of us can be proud of. And that means collaboration, inclusivity, equity, kindness, respect, and the idea that water is a sacred gift and we need to be very careful with it because we can't live without it.
Dan McCool, thank you very much.
A pleasure, Doug. Good to talk with you.
Dan McCool, he's an emeritus professor of political science at the University of Utah. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER is proud to be listener-focused and listener-supported public radio. We're grateful for our community of donors and sustainers who make monthly contributions to the station. If you rely on our programming to stay informed, become our newest sustainer with a gift of just $5 a month. Or consider an increase to your existing contribution. Get started today at KUER.org/donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about how Native American ideas about water are different from the ones that have shaped more than a century of water law and policy in the West. Now, whether you could unravel all of the layers in this current system, who knows? But a shrinking Great Salt Lake and a relentless mega drought may open up new ways of thinking. Joining us now is Andrew Curley. He's a member of the Navajo Nation and an assistant professor of geography at the University of Arizona. And he says thinking about water in indigenous communities is also complicated and also multifaceted. He says it's shaped both by the unique histories of these people and the settler colonial world they've been forced to exist in.
Tribal government actors and people working within political leadership or community leadership, mainly in reservations, are thinking about water security and in some ways water sovereignty or control and access to water sources and using that water for primarily for household needs. A lot of reservation homes don't have the same level of household water security as you would find in towns and cities outside of the reservation. And this has a lot to do with the history of colonialism and the way that the U.S. and state governments have interacted with tribes in the last 60 years. And of course, you know, there's a lot of ways in which water is understood. I think, you know, over time and through generations and centuries of living on the land, we've come to develop a sense of where water is, how to access it, and where what you can use it for. And it's not only just water sources that are surface level that are on the ground or even aquifer waters that you can find throughout the region, sometimes in caves or in wells. You also have rainwater, right? You get a sense of the weather patterns and the way that water moves across the landscape throughout the seasons. And so a lot of our movement, a lot of our geography is defined around where water is, where it comes from, and how we access it. I could just say broadly, that's probably a common characteristic many indigenous nations in North America maintain or have in common is this idea of, you know, getting at water and having a relationship with water as part of their identity and about where they're physically and how they've developed their spatial understanding about their homelands and their territories.
Mm. You know, one of the things you've been saying is that the way planners and white settlers have always seemed to understand water in the West and probably everywhere in the development of the West has been about beneficial use. You know, it's good for agriculture, it's good for growth, mm-hmm. it's good for development. What's the difference between that and seeing it as, I take it, most indigenous communities do, and that is water is a source of life? Like, what's the difference between seeing it that way and seeing it as something that's useful, you know, for a use?
When indigenous talk about water as life, you can also go back to classical political economy and even the way Marx described the way commodities come to be, and like, you know, the difference between use value and exchange value.
Yeah.
And I think what happens is the capitalist economy, especially, you know, one that has infiltrated itself within the U.S. political system, especially by the time you get to the late 19th century, and you have settlers and you have a lot of movement and movement in the interests of expanding capitalist opportunities, rail, mining, agriculture, there was a lot of emphasis on making the landscape productive for cash commodity production. The land was not seen valuable unless it was producing commodities that was within an emerging capitalist world economy. And I think that that is a fundamental difference between how we understand the landscape as, you know, using the water as a use value, as something that's sustained for use for what you consume, you know, producing the things you consume, as opposed to something that is an input as a subsidy for some other industry. And so much of the water history since settler colonialism has intruded itself on the landscape has been about diverting water, has been about damming water, has been about appropriating surface waters to the maximal use toward a certain kind of industry and an industry that is recognized within those circulation of commodity production. And so I think that's something that is a huge difference in how we understand things. And the way that that whole economy is built is not attuned to the environmental limitations and challenges that humans face generally, but more specifically in Western part of the United States, in this part of the world. The contradictions are there. They're so obvious, you know, the idea of growth and expansion, and you need cities to expand in order for the quote unquote economy to continue to survive. That economy's survival is dependent on the extinguishment of survivability for humans and other species in the area. So that's a huge contradiction, right, between the system and the living beings that are using that system. So I think that's where a core of the difference lies.
Maybe take us back to before white settlers arrived and started pushing Native people off of their land and started thinking about resources like water as, you know, creating commodities. How did indigenous people, and I don't even know if this is the right word, but how did indigenous people manage water in the past, if that's even the right way to put it? How did they think about sharing water and allocating water? And, you know, what, I don't know if there was a system in mind. Or was it a larger ethic? Like, how did it work, if you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because it's like the system has implanted this idea that we have to have a comprehensive system
right.
in order to have something as alternative to what exists now, because so much of the existing water allocation and water regime is, you know, totalizing. It's like from endpoint to endpoint of the river. And its idea is to maximize water diversion. And even to the degree where, like, if water got into the ocean, that was seen as water wasted. Mm-hmm. So because we've come from decades of thinking about water that way, it's like when we turn back to indigenous people, we're thinking, oh, what kind of system looked like that for us? And it was I don't think we had a system that was comparable to like a water rights regime. There was not a Colorado compact between the indigenous nations, you know, living in the Colorado River basin, or what is now the basin. There's ways that you can get at that question that it's like you're thinking about, okay, for one basic fact that is easy to notice among in Navajo geography is that many of our community names have water in the name. Tohlakan, Yambito, Ma'ibito, Shanto, you know, all of these things, Toh is our word for water. And these community places have water in the name because that's where you can get water. It's like it's known that water is accessible there. And within the name of that community, it's the kind of accessibility is referred. And so you have a spring, you have a water that's sitting above the ground, you know, surface water, you have aquifer water. It's making distinction between the types of water that are in those areas. There's also like a social commentary in some cases within our place names that will
so,
say.
So
like,
you're going back to geography again here. This is about place, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's spatial ordering.
Yeah.
And the way we're thinking about space, indigenous geographies. And so that's something that, you know, you can look at the place names and you can see that water is a key component defining where we live and where we're from and how we're bound to the land is also being close to sources of water and knowing how to get at that water. You could also look at our agriculture and livestock practices. You know, how was maize grown on the land, or seed, or watermelons, or other kinds of melons, or any other kind of crop? You know, like, what is a rain-fed agriculture like? Our people have histories of building dams that are not like the Hoover Dam, holding back water for diversion for irrigation and on this industrial scale, but knowing the landscape and how the water naturally flows into it, and then creating places where the water will slowly go over across the landscape and help to feed the crops that are planted in these areas. And that kind of technique is still practiced today. That's a kind of use of water, rain, and understanding of seasons and climate that doesn't require the destructions of whole ecosystems or the damming up of canyons and creation of like these large reservoirs that have really changed the way that the rivers in the region run and work. So so you can look at that, you know, the different kinds of agricultural practices we had. The water becomes a very important spatial marker, and it defines economies, where it is and how you can access it. And it creates social connections. And it's not just with indigenous peoples, it's with settler communities. That's why you have the Colorado Compact. Yeah. It has a social dimension to it. The problem is that the social dimension is exclusionary when it comes to settler colonialism, and is enforced through the violence of the state, you know, and how it's able to push its projects, its funding of infrastructures that divert water and prevent it from getting to other communities.
Yeah.
The scale of that kind of intrusion onto the landscape was not happening among indigenous nations, even if we were using the same water sources.
So the way we've come to think about water in the West then is through this legal process and this political process. It's come to be about water rights. And I wonder if you think, is there any going back now? I mean, these water laws, this water infrastructure, it's in place. How could we back out of it at this point? How could we start a process of rethinking about it, if that's even possible?
Yeah, I mean, we could rethink about it. Now, getting the political will to do right. something is a, yeah. is a different question. But like, our big infrastructure here in Arizona is the Central Arizona Project. And I was taking a class. They offer these community classes, and I registered and I took the class for the CAP. And they just tell you everything about the CAP, you know, its history, how it works, you know, all of these kinds of a lot of technical details I wasn't aware of. And then they give you this form where you can ask questions. And I was like, hey, can we get rid of all of this?
Right.
It took them 2 weeks to respond. And then they were like, that would be too expensive and too hard to do. Or some, you know, they basically rejected the question. But it was like, that's the thing about these infrastructures, is they create this sense of inevitability and permanence. Of course, any dam can come down. Any dam can be removed. It's just getting people to that sense that that's the best solution moving forward. And that's a lot of social political work. I don't think we go back. We don't go backward in time. Mm-hmm. We don't really go forward in time in the way we understand it. Inevitably, our value system is going to adapt to what's there, right? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, if we were to come to some sort of constructive solution between indigenous nations and replacing the water rights regime with something else, there are ways we can do that with the existing ways people are living, meaning like that there is a city of Phoenix, that there is a city of Tucson, mm-hmm. but we come up with water budgets. We come up with ways that are prohibit certain kinds of activities, certain kinds of wastefulness in the uses of water. You know, be very mindful of the landscape in which we inhabit and to reduce the total water use per person. But if we even move from the rights to the responsibility model, from moving away from rights to like a riparian, like we are responsible for people downstream as much as the people upstream are responsible for us, yeah. and ensuring that water gets to us. If we start thinking about our communities in responsible relationship with each other, instead of like, I have absolute right to this water and who cares who's downstream from me, that would be a huge transformative shift in just the way we think about water here.
Andrew Curley, he's an assistant professor of geography at the University of Arizona. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER keeps you connected on the air and in your inbox with our weekly newsletters. Hear the latest stories, station projects, and other KUER news with Station Insider. Radio West's newsletter gives fans a behind-the-scenes look and extras from each week's show. And She Votes Utah delivers fresh information for all your political and voting needs. Sign up today at KUER.org/newsletters.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about how Native Americans think about water and whether you could apply those principles to the way we manage it here in the West. We've been talking to experts who make the case that indigenous ways of knowing water could help us cope with a future of scarcity. Back now to our conversation with Andrew Curley. He's an assistant professor of geography at the University of Arizona. Speaking as a white guy, here's how I think we get caught up in trying to understand the indigenous point of view and apply it. We were talking with Dan McCool about these bluff principles that were developed in 2016, indigenous principles for dealing with water in the West. And some of them are kind of abstract. Like the idea that water is precious, that it's a gift provided by a creator, that you need to take into account everyone along the river, So how do you talk to people who think in a more linear way about how you apply this to the really complicated business of managing water in the West? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And abstract ideas get filled out by, the questions that are at hand, and it can go in this is an abstract answer to an abstract question, but look at the way the Supreme Court takes abstractions in the Constitution and then does really strange things with it, we've just witnessed this recently. And so first, it's interesting to get to know your own water rights system and how those are based on abstract ideas, beneficial use, right? What does that mean? Mm-hmm. And then that gets fleshed out over time, right? And that gets fleshed out to mean something very specific. Like I said, you look over the history of how that principle has been applied, and it goes towards these large-scale industrial users or commodity cash crops, And that's fleshed out through practice, right? You take this idea of beneficial use, and beneficial use can be something like sustainability, but that's not how it's applied, right? And it's applied in a way that's very destructive to the ecosystem. And how did that happen? Because you empowered certain kinds of people to interpret the meaning of that. Right. So I guess if it's too abstract for white people, just put Indian people in charge and let them figure out what that means.
This
is what we mean by it.
Well, so let's get to this question that – so one of the things that you have said, and I wanted to hear you more on this, is that the environmental crisis that we're facing right now isn't just based on climate change or the fact that we're in the midst of a mega drought. That, as you've said, we need to think about it also as an intrusion on the landscape. Say a little bit more about that, because it seems like you're thinking more deeply about that part as well.
The issue with climate change is, even though we're talking in the temporally, meaning how we think about time, we're thinking in these huge epochs beyond a lifetime comprehension, right? We're talking about scenes. Anthropocene, they're like Earth's history, right? The history of the planet. And that's kind of the arena in which the climate change discourse, the time arena. But at the same time, we feel like it's very recent. It's like something that happened since the industrialization era. So what I'm trying to say is the climate change discourse, even though it's talking about time across this large scale, it's also very recent, and it's about kind of our recent politics, kind of very contemporary politics. And I think one thing that we forget are some of these huge environmental transformative events that happened before we even started talking about climate change, the damming of these rivers. And so what I'm saying is that's a form of climate change. You hold back water behind a huge concrete barrier, you're changing the climate. You're changing the way that the water moves. You're fundamentally changing the environment around you. And you're doing more damage to that river than what is even happening with climate change right now, than even kind of these effects of climate change that we're discussing and debating, like, or anticipating. And so it's like those things become naturalized on the landscape, and then these other future effects that haven't happened or are happening in real time and we're debating about, those are the things we're focused on. And it's like, why don't we return back to this diversion of water, this division of the water between the seven Colorado River basin states, the overallocation of water to all of these different interests, the denial of indigenous accessibility to these waters, and, you know, only putting them in the form of these very punitive water settlements. You want to talk about water, we need to also talk about just this whole system, the water regime that we have throughout the West, the water rights logic, the codes within the states. So I think these are the areas where we really need to pay a lot of attention to. And they're not easy politics to overcome by any means. It's not like it would take a lot of organizing, public education, momentum, and a clear alternative. And I think that's what you're yearning for here is what is our alternative, right? Yes. What is an alternative system here? And that's something that, I think has to be discussed among all of us that live in this area.
Yeah. I keep wanting a system, don't I?
Yeah. Well, you're not the first person to ask this question, right? So it's something that I've heard before, and it's like, what can we have as opposed to this thing that we have now? Yeah. And that's not an easy question to answer because this thing was constructed really in order to be permanent and inevitable. Mm.
I'm not sure how useful counterfactuals ever are, but do you ever entertain them? Do you ever wonder, what if, we had included in the earlier days of development of the West? What if we had included Native ideas about water back in those days when all of this water law was being developed? You know, what would have been different? How would this space, this place, have looked different? You know, how would we have behaved differently? What do you think?
Yeah, no, I actually like counterfactuals, even though I also don't know how useful they are.
Yeah.
But I think it does help us to kind of have an imagination, or it helps us to break up some of these ideas that are too solid in our minds. And yeah, so if we took like what ifs, right? What if beneficial use was replaced with sustainable use? What if that became law early on? I think, we would have to, it would have challenged a lot of schemes, a lot of projects. It would have forced communities to think about what they're about in ways that are different than the history that developed. And, agriculture might have taken a totally different shape and form in the Western states. And I think communities could have coexisted. We have examples of indigenous people selling land or allowing for non-native people, other people from different tribes or even white people for living in and around the area. And there's ways that we could accommodate communities without settler colonialism, without the thieving of land, without the damming of water sources and the prevention of surface waters getting to reservations or reservations not being the end point, but getting to native communities. And so like the what ifs, if we put these kind of like, again, these abstract, if we replace some of them, if we took beneficial use and replace it with sustainable use, if we took, first in use, first in right, and we said, first in use, first responsible, like that person sets the regime going forward on how, not how much water they can take, but how they take care of the water. How they make ensure that it continues to flow without interruption and to provide a habitat for certain species and a water source for others, non-human persons and other things. And so if we started to replace those ideas early on, we would have had totally different kinds of outcomes with how community development occurred across what we now call the Western states. And we wouldn't be in the kind of crisis, and we would be looking today back in the past and say, I'm glad we didn't go down that other road when these crazy people came in and said, let's expropriate every amount of water we can and call it an acre foot using this minor logic of water quantification and, you know, flood fields and use it only for crops we can't consume. If, you know, I'm glad we didn't end up doing that. That would have been disaster. I think that would have been the counterfactual, as we would be looking back and being thankful we didn't take the choice that we actually did take. So that's kind of a pessimistic way to think about it. But I mean, you know, it tells us how we got to where we are in some ways.
Professor, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you for the questions.
Andrew Curley, he's a member of the Navajo Nation and an assistant professor of geography at the University of Arizona. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. The program is produced by Carrie Watson, Benjamin Bombard, and Tim Slover. Stephanie Allerton is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.